emotion. In fact, the 1913 paper was deeply important emotionally to Bohr. It is a remarkable example of how science works and of the sense of personal authentication that scientific discovery can bestow. Bohr's emotional preoccupations sensitized him to see previously unperceived regularities in the natural world. The parallels between his early psychological concerns and his interpretation of atomic processes are uncanny, so much so that without the great predictive ability of the paper, its assumptions would seem totally arbitrary. Whether or not the will is free, for example, was a question that Bohr took seriously. To identify a kind of freedom of choice within the atom itself was a triumph for his carefully assembled structure of beliefs. The separate, distinct electron orbits that Bohr called stationary states recall Kierkegaard's stages. They also recall Bohr's attempt to redefine the problem of free will by invoking separate, distinct Riemann surfaces. And as Kierkegaard's stages are discontinuous, negotiable only by leaps of faith, so do Bohr's electrons leap discontinuously from orbit to orbit. Bohr insists, as one of the two principal assumptions of his paper, that the electrons' whereabouts between orbits cannot be calculated or even visualized. Before and after are completely discontinuous. In that sense, each stationary state of the electron is complete and unique, and in that wholeness is stability. By contrast, the continuous process predicted by classical mechanics, which Bohr apparently associated with the licentiate's endless ratiocination, tears the atom apart or spirals it into radiative collapse. Bohr may have found his way through his youthful emotional crisis in part by calling up his childhood gift of literal-mindedness. He famously insisted on anchoring physics in fact and refused to carry argument beyond physical evidence. He was never a system builder. Bohr characteristically avoids such a word as principle, says Rosenfeld. He prefers to speak of point of view, or better still, argument, that is, line of reasoning. Likewise, he rarely mentions the laws of nature, but rather refers to regularities of the phenomena. Bohr was not displaying false humility with his choice of terms. He was reminding himself and his colleagues that physics is not a grand philosophical system of authoritarian command, but simply a way, in his favorite phrase, of asking questions of nature. He apologized similarly for his tentative, rambling habit of speech. I try not to speak more clearly than I think. He points out, Rosenfeld adds, that the idealized concepts we use in science must ultimately derive from common experiences of daily life, which cannot themselves be further analyzed. Therefore, whenever any two such idealizations turn out to be incompatible, this can only mean that some mutual limitation is imposed upon their validity. Bohr had found a solution to the spiraling flights of doubt by stepping out of what Kierkegaard called the fairyland of the imagination and back into the real world. In the real world, material objects endure. Their atoms cannot then ordinarily be unstable. In the real world, cause and effect sometimes seem to limit our freedom, but at other times, we know we choose. In the real world, it is meaningless to doubt existence. The doubt itself demonstrates the existence of the doubter. Much of the difficulty was language, that slippery medium in which Bohr saw us inextricably suspended. It is wrong, he told his colleagues repeatedly, to think that the task of physics is to find out how nature is, which is the territory classical physics had claimed for itself. Physics concerns what we can say about nature. Later, Bohr would develop far more elaborately the idea of mutual limitations as a guide to greater understanding. It would supply a deep philosophical basis for his statecraft as well as for his physics. In 1913, he first demonstrated its resolving power. It was clear, he remembered, at the end of his life. And that was the point about the Rutherford atom, that we had something from which we could not proceed at all in any other way than by radical change. And that was the reason, then, that I took it up so seriously.
4. The long grave already dug. Otto Hahn cherished the day the Kaiser came to visit. The official dedication of the first two Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, one for chemistry, one for physical chemistry, on October 23, 1919, Bohr in Copenhagen was approaching his quantized atom, was a wet day in the suburb of Dahlem, southwest of Berlin. The Kaiser, Wilhelm II, Victoria's eldest grandson, wore a rain cloak to protect his uniform, the dark collar of his greatcoat turned out over the lighter shawl of the cloak. The officials who walked the requisite paces behind him, his scholarly friend Adolf von Harnack and the distinguished chemist Emil Fischer foremost among them, made do with dark coats and top hats. Those farther back in the procession who carried umbrellas kept them furled. Schoolboys, caps in hand, lined the curbs of the shining street like soldiers on parade. They stood at childish attention, awe dazing their dreamy faces, as this corpulent middle-aged man with upturned dark mustaches, who believed he ruled them by divine right, passed in review. They were 13, perhaps 14 years old. They would be soldiers soon enough. Officials in the Ministry of Culture had encouraged His Imperial Majesty to support German science. He responded by donating land for a research center on what had been a royal farm. Industry and government then lavishly endowed a science foundation, the Kaiser Wilhelm Society, to operate the proposed institutes, of which there would be 7 by 1914. The society began its official life early in 1911 with von Harnack, a theologian who was the son of a chemist, as its first president. The imperial architect, Ernst von Inn, went briskly to work. The Kaiser came to Dahlem to dedicate the first two finished buildings, and the Institute for Chemistry especially must have pleased him. It was set back on a broad lawn at the corner of the Allee and Feradweg, 3 stories of cut stone filigreed with 6 paned windows, a steep gabled slate roof, and at the roofline high above the entrance, a classical pediment supported by 4 Doric columns. A wing angled off paralleling the cross street, fitted between the main building and the wing like a hinge, a round tower rose up dramatically 4 stories high. Von Inn had surmounted the tower with a dome. Apparently the dome was meant to flatter the Kaiser's taste. A sense of humor was not one of Wilhelm II's strong points, and no doubt it did. The dome took the form of a giant Pickelhaube, the comic opera spiked helmet that the Kaiser and his soldiers wore. Leaving Ernest Rutherford in Montreal in 1906, Hahn had moved to Berlin to work with Emil Fischer at the university. Fischer was an organic chemist who knew little about radioactivity, but he understood that the field was opening to importance and that Hahn was a first-rate man. He made room for Hahn in a wood shop in the basement of his laboratories and arranged Hahn's appointment as a Privatdozent, which stirred less forward-looking chemists on the faculty to wonder aloud at the deplorable decline in standards. A chemist who claimed to identify new elements with a gold foil electroscope must be at least an embarrassment, if not in fact a fraud. Hahn found the university's physicists more congenial than its chemists and regularly attended the physics colloquia. At one colloquium at the beginning of the autumn term in 1907, he met an Austrian woman, Lise Meitner, who had just arrived from Vienna. Meitner was 29, 1 year older than Hahn. She had earned her PhD at the University of Vienna and had already published 2 papers on alpha and beta radiation. Max Planck's lectures in theoretical physics had drawn her to Berlin for postgraduate study. Hahn was a gymnast, a skier, and a mountain climber, boyishly good-looking, fond of beer and cigars, with a Rhineland drawl and a warm, self-deprecating sense of humor. He admired attractive women, went out of his way to cultivate them, and stayed friends with a number of them throughout his happily married life. Meitner was petite, dark, and pretty, if also morbidly shy. Hahn befriended her. When she found she had free time, she decided to experiment. She needed a collaborator.
So did Hahn.
A physicist and a radiochemist. They would make a productive team. They required a laboratory. Fisher agreed that Meitner could share the woodshop on condition that she never show her face in the laboratory upstairs where the students, all male, worked. For 2 years, she observed the condition strictly. Then, with the liberalization of the university, Fisher relented, allowed women into his classes, and Meitner above the basement. Vienna had been only a little more enlightened. Meitner's father, an attorney, the Meitners were assimilated Austrian Jews, baptized all around, had insisted that she acquire a teacher's diploma in French before beginning to study physics, so that she would always be able to support herself. Only then could she prepare for university work. With the diploma out of the way, Meitner crammed 8 years of gymnasium preparation into two. She was the second woman ever to earn a PhD at Vienna. Her father subsidized her research in Berlin until at least 1912, when Max Planck, by now a warm supporter, appointed her to an assistantship. The German Madame Curie, Einstein would call her, characteristically lumping the Germanic peoples together and forgetting her Austrian birth. "There was no question," says Hahn, "of any closer relationship between us outside the laboratory. Lise Meitner had had a strict, ladylike upbringing and was very reserved, even shy. They never ate lunch together, never went for a walk, met only in colloquia and in the woodshop, and yet we were really close friends. She whistled Brahms and Schumann to him to pass the long hours taking timed readings of radioactivity to establish identifying half-lives. And when Rutherford came through Berlin in 1908 on his way back from the Nobel Prize ceremonies, she selflessly accompanied Mary Rutherford shopping while the two men indulged themselves in long talks. The close friends moved together to the new institute in 1912 and worked to prepare an exhibit for the Kaiser. In his first venture into radiochemistry, in London before he went to Montreal, Hahn had spied out what he took to be a new element, radiothorium, that was 100,000 times as radioactive as its modest namesake. At McGill, he found a third substance intermediate between the other two. He named it mesothorium, and it was later identified as an isotope of radium. Mesothorium compounds glow in the dark at a different level of faint illumination from radiothorium compounds. Hahn thought the difference might amuse his sovereign. On a velvet cushion in a little box, he mounted an unshielded sample of mesothorium, equivalent in radiation intensity to 300 milligrams of radium. He presented his potent offering to the Kaiser and asked him to compare it to an emanating sample of radiothorium that produced in the dark very nice luminous moving shapes on a screen. No one warned His Majesty of the radiation hazard because no safety standards for radiation exposure had yet been set. "If I did the same thing today," Hahn said 50 years later, "I should find myself in prison." The mesothorium caused no obvious harm. The Kaiser passed on to the second institute, half a block up Feradwig, northwest, beyond the angled wing. Two senior chemists managed the chemistry institute where Hahn and Meitner worked, but the Institute for Physical Chemistry and Electrochemistry, to give it its full name, was established specifically for the man who was its first director, a difficult, inventive German-Jewish chemist from Breslau named Fritz Haber. It was a reward of sorts. A German industrial foundation paid for it and endowed it because in 1909, Haber had succeeded in developing a practical method of extracting nitrogen from the air to make ammonia. The ammonia would serve for artificial fertilizer, replacing Germany's and the world's principal natural source, sodium nitrate dug from the bone-dry northern deserts of Chile, an expensive and insecure supply. More strategically, the Haber process would be invaluable in time of war to produce nitrates for explosives. Germany had no nitrates of its own. Kaiser Wilhelm enlarged at the dedication on the dangers of fire damp, the explosive mixture of methane and other gases that accumulates in mines. He urged his chemists to find some early means of detection. "That was a task," he said, "worthy of the sweat of noble brows." Haber, noble brow, he shaved his bullet head, wore round horn-rimmed glasses and a toothbrush mustache, dressed well, wined and dined in elegance, but suffered bitter marital discord, set out to invent a fire-damp whistle that would sound a different pitch when dangerous gases were present. With a fine modern laboratory uncontaminated by old radioactivity, Hahn and Meitner went to work at radiochemistry and the new field of nuclear physics. The Kaiser returned from Dahlem to his palace in Berlin, happy to have lent his name to yet another organ of burgeoning German power. In the summer of 1913, Niels Bohr sailed with his young wife to England. He followed the second and third parts of his epical paper, which he had sent ahead by mail to Rutherford. He wanted to discuss them before releasing them for publication. In Manchester, he met his friend George de Hevesy again and some of the other research men. One he met, probably for the first time, was Henry Gwynne Jeffreys Moseley, called Harry, an Eton boy and an Oxford man who had worked for Rutherford as a demonstrator, teaching undergraduates since 1910. Harry Moseley, at 26, was poised for great accomplishment. He needed only the catalyst of Bohr's visit to set him off. Moseley was a loner, so reserved, says A.S. Russell, that I could neither like him nor not like him. But with the unfortunate habit of allowing no loose statement of fact to pass unchallenged. When he stopped work long enough to take tea at the laboratory, he even managed to inhibit Ernest Rutherford. Rutherford's other boys called him Papa. Moseley respected the boisterous laureate, but certainly never honored him with any such intimacy. He rather thought Rutherford played the stage colonial. Harry came from a distinguished line of scientists. His great-grandfather had operated a lunatic asylum with healing enthusiasm, but without benefit of medical license. But his grandfather was chaplain and professor of natural philosophy and astronomy at King's College. And his father had sailed as a biologist on the 3-year voyage of HMS Challenger that produced a 50-volume pioneering study of the world ocean. Henry Moseley, Harry had his father's first name, won the friendly praise of Charles Darwin for his 1-volume popular account, Notes by a Naturalist on the Challenger. Harry, in his turn, would work with Darwin's physicist grandson, Charles G. Darwin, at Manchester. If he was reserved to the point of stuffiness, he was also indefatigable at experiment. He would go all out for 15 hours, well into the night, until he was exhausted, eat a Spartan meal of cheese sometime before dawn, find a few hours for sleep, and breakfast at noon on fruit salad. He was trim, carefully dressed, and conservative, fond of his sisters and his widowed mother, to whom he regularly wrote chatty and warmly devoted letters. Hay fever threw off his final honors examinations at Oxford. He despised teaching the Manchester undergraduates. Many were foreigners, Hindus, Burmese, Jap, Egyptian, and other vile forms of Indian. And he recoiled from their scented dirtiness. But finally, in the autumn of 1912, Harry found his great subject. "Some Germans have recently got wonderful results by passing X-rays through crystals and then photographing them," he wrote to his mother on October 10th. The Germans, at Munich, were directed by Max von Laue. Von Laue had found that the orderly, repetitive atomic structure of a crystal produces monochromatic interference patterns from X-rays, just as the mirroring, slightly separated inner and outer surfaces of a soap bubble produce interference patterns of color from white light. X-ray crystallography was the discovery that would win von Laue the Nobel Prize. Moseley and C.G. Darwin set out with a will to explore the new field. They acquired the necessary equipment and worked through the winter. By May 1913, they had advanced to using crystals as spectroscopes and were finishing up a first solid piece of work. X-rays are energetic light of extremely short wavelength. The atomic lattices of crystals spread out their spectra, much as a prism does visible light. "We find," Moseley wrote his mother on May 18th, "that an X-ray bulb with a platinum target gives out a sharp line spectrum of 5 wavelengths. Tomorrow we search for the spectra of other elements. There is here a whole new branch of spectroscopy, which is sure to tell one much about the nature of the atom." Then Bohr arrived,
and the question they discussed was Bohr's old insight that the order of the elements in the periodic table ought to follow the atomic number rather than, as chemists thought, the atomic weight. The atomic number of uranium, for example, is 92. The atomic weight of the commonest isotope of uranium is 238. A rarer isotope of uranium has an atomic weight of 235 and the same atomic number. Harry could look for regular shifts in the wavelengths of X-ray line spectra and prove Bohr's contention. Atomic number would make a place in the periodic table for all the variant physical forms that had been discovered and that would soon be named isotopes. Atomic number, emphasizing the charge on the nucleus as the determiner of the number of electrons and hence of the chemistry, would strongly confirm Rutherford's nuclear model of the atom. The X-ray spectral lines would further document Bohr's quantized electron orbits. The work would be Moseley's alone. Darwin, by then, had withdrawn to pursue other interests. Bohr and the patient Margrethe went on to Cambridge to vacation and publish Bohr's paper. Rutherford left near the end of July with Mary on an expedition to the idyllic mountains of the Tyrol. Moseley stayed in unbearably hot and stuffy Manchester, blowing glass. Even now, near midnight, he wrote his mother 2 days after Rutherford's departure, "I discard coat and waistcoat and work with windows and door open to try to get some air. I will come to you as soon as I can get my apparatus to work before ever I start measurements." On August 13th, he was still at it. He wrote his married sister Marjorie to explain what he was after. "I want in this way to find the wavelengths of the X-ray spectra of as many elements as possible, as I believe they will prove much more important and fundamental than the ordinary light spectra. The method of finding the wavelengths is to reflect the X-rays, which come from a target of the element investigated, when such a target is bombarded with cathode rays. I have then merely to find at which angles the rays are reflected, and that gives the wavelengths. I aim at an accuracy of at least 1 in 1,000. The Bohrs returned to Copenhagen, the Rutherfords from the Tyrol, and now it was September, and time for the annual meeting of the British Association, this year in Birmingham. Bohr had not planned to attend, especially after lingering overlong in Cambridge, but Rutherford thought he should. His quantized atom, with its stunning spectral predictions, would be the talk of the conference. Bohr relented and rushed over. Birmingham's hotels were booked tight. He slept the first night on a billiard table. Then the resourceful de Hevesy found him a berth in a girls' college. And that was very, very practical and wonderful, Bohr remembered afterward, adding quickly that the girls were away. Sir Oliver Lodge, president of the British Association, mentioned Bohr's work in his opening address. Rutherford touted it in meetings. James Jeans, the Cambridge mathematical physicist, allowed wittily that the only justification at present put forward for these assumptions is the very weighty one of success. A Cavendish physicist, Francis W. Aston, announced that he had succeeded in separating two different weights of neon by tediously diffusing a large sample over and over again several thousand times through pipe clay. A definite proof, de Hevesy noted, that elements of different atomic weight can have the same chemical properties. Marie Curie came across from France. Shy, says A.S. Eve, retiring, self-possessed, and noble. She fended off the bulldog British press by praising Rutherford. Great developments, she predicted, were likely to transpire from his work. He was the one man living who promises to confer some inestimable boon on mankind. Harold Bohr reported to his brother that autumn that the younger men at Göttingen do not dare to believe that your paper can be objectively right. They find the assumptions too bold and fantastic. Against the continuing skepticism of many European physicists, Bohr heard from de Hevesy that Einstein himself, encountered at a conference in Vienna, had been deeply impressed. De Hevesy passed along a similar tale to Rutherford. Speaking with Einstein on different topics, we came to speak on Bohr's theory. He told me that he had once similar ideas, but he did not dare to publish them. Should Bohr's theory be right, it is of the greatest importance. When I told him about the recent discovery of spectral lines where Bohr's theory had predicted they should appear, the big eyes of Einstein looked still bigger, and he told me, "Then it is one of the greatest discoveries." I felt very happy hearing Einstein saying so. So did Bohr. Moseley labored on. He had trouble at first making sharp photographs of his X-ray spectra, but once he got the hang of it, the results were outstanding. The important spectral lines shifted with absolute regularity as he went up the periodic table, one step at a time. He devised a little staircase of strips of film by matching up the lines. He wrote to Bohr on November 16th, "During the last fortnight or so, I have been getting results which will interest you. So far, I have dealt with the K spectral line series from calcium to zinc. The results are exceedingly simple and largely what you would expect. K equals N minus 1, very exactly, N being the atomic number." He had calcium at 20, scandium at 21, titanium at 22, vanadium at 23, chromium at 24, and so on, up to zinc at 30. He concludes that his results lend great weight to the general principles which you use, and I am delighted that this is so, as your theory is having a splendid effect on physics. Harry Moseley's crisp work gave experimental confirmation of the Bohr-Rutherford atom that was far more solidly acceptable than Marsden's and Geiger's alpha scattering experiments. "Because you see," Bohr said in his last interview, "actually the Rutherford work was not taken seriously. We cannot understand today, but it was not taken seriously at all. The great change came from Moseley." Otto Hahn was called upon once more to demonstrate his radioactive preparations. In the early spring of 1914, the Bayer Dye Works at Leverkusen, near Cologne in the Rhineland, gave a reception to celebrate the opening of a large lecture hall. Germany's chemical industry led the world, and Bayer was the largest chemical company in Germany, with more than 10,000 employees. It manufactured some 2,000 different dyestuffs, large tonnages of inorganic chemicals, a range of pharmaceuticals. The firm's managing director, Carl Duisberg, a chemist who preferred industrial management along American lines, had invited the Oberpräsident of the Rhineland to attend the reception. He then invited Hahn to add a glow to the proceedings. Hahn lectured to the dignitaries on radioactivity. Near the beginning of the lecture, he wrote Duisberg's name on a sealed photographic plate with a small glass tube filled with strong mesothorium. Technicians developed the plate while he spoke. At the end, Hahn projected the radiographic signature onto a screen to appreciative applause. The high point of the celebration at the vast 900-acre chemical complex came in the evening. "In the evening, there was a banquet," Hahn remembered with nostalgia. "Everything was exquisite. On each of the little tables there was a beautiful orchid brought from Holland by air. Orchids delivered by swift biplane might be adequate symbols of German prosperity and power in 1914, but the managing director wanted to demonstrate German technological superiority as well, and found exotic statement. At many of the tables," says Hahn, evoking an unrecognizably futuristic past, "the wine was cooled by means of liquid air in thermos vessels." When war broke out, Niels and Harold Bohr were hiking in the Austrian Alps, covering as much as 22 miles a day. "It is impossible to describe how amazing and wonderful it is," Niels had written to Margarethe along the way. "When the fog on the mountain suddenly comes driving down from all the peaks, initially as quite small clouds, finally to fill the whole valley." The brothers had planned to return home August 6th. The war suddenly came driving down like the mountain fog, and they rushed across Germany before the frontiers closed. In October, Bohr would sail with his wife from neutral Denmark to teach for 2 years at Manchester. Rutherford, his boys off to war work, needed help. Harry Moseley was in Australia with his mother at the beginning of August, attending the 1914 British Association meeting, in his spare time searching out the duck-billed platypus and picturesque silver mines. The patriotism of the Australians, who immediately began mobilizing, triggered his own Etonian spirit of loyalty to king and country. He sailed for England as soon as he could book passage. By late October, he had gingered up a reluctant recruiting officer to arrange his commission as a lieutenant in the Royal Engineers, ahead of the waiting list. Chaim Weizmann, the tall, sturdy, Russian-born Jewish biochemist who was Ernest Rutherford's good friend at Manchester, was a passionate Zionist at a time when many, including many influential British Jews, believed Zionism to be at least visionary and naive, if not wrong-headed, fanatic, even a menace. But if Weizmann was a Zionist, he was also deeply admiring of British democracy. And one of his first acts after the beginning of the war was to cut himself off from the International Zionist Organization because it proposed to remain neutral. Its European leaders hated Tsarist Russia, England's ally, and so did Weizmann. But unlike them, he did not believe that Germany, in cultural and technological superiority, would win the war. He believed that the Western democracies would emerge victorious and that Jewish destiny lay with them. He, his wife, and his young son had been en route to a holiday in Switzerland at the outbreak of the war. They worked their way back to Paris, where he visited the elderly Baron Edmund de Rothschild, financial mainstay of the pioneering Jewish agricultural settlements in Palestine. To Weizmann's astonishment, Rothschild shared his optimism about the eventual outcome of the war and its possibilities for Jewry. Though Weizmann had no official position in the Zionist movement, Rothschild urged him to seek out and talk to British leaders. That matched his own inclinations. His hope of British influence had deep roots. He was the third child among 15 of a timber merchant who assembled rafts of logs and floated them down the Vistula to Danzig for milling and export. The Weizmanns lived in that impoverished western region of Russia, cordoned off for the Jews, known as the Pale of Settlement. When Chaim was only 11, he had written a letter that prefigured his work in the war. The 11-year-old boy, reports his biographer Isaiah Berlin, says that the kings and nations of the world are plainly set upon the ruin of the Jewish nation. The Jews must not let themselves be destroyed. England alone may help them to return and rise again in their ancient land of Palestine. Young Weizmann's conviction drove him inexorably west. At 18, he floated on one of his father's rafts to West Prussia, worked his way to Berlin, and studied at the Technische Hochschule. In 1899, he took his Ph.D. at the University of Fribourg in Switzerland, then sold a patent to Bayer that considerably improved his finances. He moved to England in 1904, a move he thought a deliberate and desperate step. "I was in danger of degenerating into a Luftmensch, literally an airman. One of those well-meaning, undisciplined, and frustrated eternal students." Chemical research would save him from that fate. He settled in Manchester under the sponsorship of William Henry Perkin, Jr., the head of the chemistry department there, whose father had established the British coal tar dye industry by isolating aniline blue, the purple dye after which the Mauve Decade was named. Returning to Manchester from France in late August 1914, Weizmann found a circular on his desk from the British War Office, inviting every scientist in possession of any discovery of military value to report it. He possessed such a discovery, and forthwith offered it to the War Office, without remuneration. The War Office chose not to reply. Weizmann went on with his research. At the same time, he began the approach to British leaders that he and Rothschild had discussed that would elaborate into some 2,000 interviews before the end of the war. Weizmann's discovery was a bacillus and a process. The bacillus was Clostridium acetobutylicum Weizmann, informally called BY, Bacillus Weizmann, an anaerobic organism that decomposes starch. He was trying to develop a process for making synthetic rubber when he found it on an ear of corn. He thought he could make synthetic rubber from isoamyl alcohol, which is a minor byproduct of alcoholic fermentation.
He went looking for a basilisk. Millions of species and subspecies live in the soil and on plants that converted starch to isoamyl alcohol more efficiently than known strains. In the course of this investigation, I found a bacterium which produced considerable amounts of a liquid smelling very much like isoamyl alcohol. But when I distilled it, it turned out to be a mixture of acetone and butyl alcohol in very pure form. Professor Perkins advised me to pour the stuff down the sink, but I retorted that no pure chemical is useless or ought to be thrown away. That creature of serendipity was BY. Mixed with a mash of cooked corn, it fermented the mash into a solution of water and three solvents, one part ethyl alcohol, three parts acetone, six parts butyl alcohol, butanol. The three solvents could then be separated by straightforward distillation. Weizmann tried developing a process for making synthetic rubber from butanol and succeeded. In the meantime, in the years just prior to the beginning of the war, the price of natural rubber fell, and the clamor for synthetic rubber stilled. Pursuing his efforts toward a Jewish homeland, Weizmann acquired in Manchester a loyal and influential friend, C.P. Scott, the tall, elderly, liberal editor of the Manchester Guardian. Among his many connections, Scott was David Lloyd George's most intimate political advisor. Weizmann found himself having breakfast one Friday morning in January 1915 with the vigorous little Welshman, who was then Chancellor of the Exchequer and who would become Prime Minister in the middle of the war. Lloyd George had been raised on the Bible. He respected the idea of a Jewish return to Palestine, especially when Weizmann eloquently compared rocky, mountainous, diminutive Palestine with rocky, mountainous, diminutive Wales. Besides Lloyd George, Weizmann was surprised to find interest in Zionism among such men as Arthur Balfour, the former Prime Minister, who would serve as Foreign Secretary in Lloyd George's cabinet, and Jan Christian Smuts, the highly respected Boer, who joined the British War Cabinet in 1917 after serving behind the scenes previously. "Really messianic times are upon us," Weizmann wrote his wife during this period of early hope. Weizmann had cultured BY primarily for its butanol. He happened one day to tell the chief research chemist of the Scottish branch of the Nobel Explosives Company about his fermentation research. The man was impressed. "You know," he said to Weizmann, "you may have the key to a very important situation in your hands." A major industrial explosion prevented Nobel from developing the process, but the company let the British government know. "So it came about," writes Weizmann, "that one day in March 1915, I returned from a visit to Paris to find waiting for me a summons to the British Admiralty. The Admiralty, of which Winston Churchill, at 41, exactly Weizmann's age, was First Lord, faced a severe shortage of acetone. That acrid solvent was a crucial ingredient in the manufacture of cordite, a propellant used in heavy artillery, including naval guns, that takes its name from the cord-like form in which it is usually extruded. The explosive material that hurled the heavy shells of the British Navy's big guns from ship to ship and ship to shore across miles of intervening water was a mixture of 64 parts nitrocellulose and 30.2 parts nitroglycerin, stabilized with 5 parts petroleum jelly and softened, gelatinized, with 0.8% acetone. Cordite could not be manufactured without acetone, and without cordite, the guns would need to be extensively rebuilt to accommodate hotter propellants that would otherwise quickly erode their barrels. Weizmann agreed to see what he could do. Shortly, he was brought into the presence of the First Lord. As Weizmann remembered the experience of meeting the brisk, fascinating, charming, and energetic Winston Churchill, almost his first words were, "Well, Dr. Weizmann, we need 30,000 tons of acetone. Can you make it?" I was so terrified by this lordly request that I almost turned tail. I answered, "So far, I have succeeded in making a few hundred cubic centimeters of acetone at a time by the fermentation process. I do my work in a laboratory. I am not a technician. I am only a research chemist. But if I were somehow able to produce a ton of acetone, I would be able to multiply that by any factor you chose." I was given carte blanche by Mr. Churchill and the department, and I took upon myself a task which was to tax all my energies for the next 2 years.
That was part one of Weizmann's acetone experience. Part two came in early June. The British War Cabinet had been shuffled in May because of the enlarging disaster of the Dardanelles campaign at Gallipoli. Herbert Asquith, the Prime Minister, had required Churchill's resignation as First Lord of the Admiralty and replaced him with Arthur Balfour. Lloyd George had moved from Chancellor of the Exchequer to Minister of Munitions. Lloyd George thus immediately inherited the acetone problem in the wider context of Army as well as Navy needs. Scott of the Manchester Guardian alerted him to Weizmann's work, and the two men met on June 7th. Weizmann told him what he had told Churchill previously. Lloyd George was impressed and gave him larger carte blanche to scale up his fermentation process. In 6 months of experiments at the Nicholson Gin Factory in Bow, Weizmann achieved half-ton scale. The process proved efficient. It fermented 37 tons of solvents, about 11 tons of acetone, from 100 tons of grain. Weizmann began training industrial chemists while the government took over 6 English, Scottish, and Irish distilleries to accommodate them. A shortage of American corn, German submarines strangled British shipping in the First War as in the Second, threatened to shut down the operations. Horse chestnuts were plentiful, notes Lloyd George in his war memoirs, and a national collection of them was organized for the purpose of using their starch content as a substitute for maize. Eventually, acetone production was shifted to Canada and the United States, and back to corn. When our difficulties were solved through Dr. Weizmann's genius, continues Lloyd George, I said to him, "You have rendered great service to the state, and I should like to ask the Prime Minister to recommend you to His Majesty for some honor." He said, "There is nothing I want for myself, but is there nothing we can do as a recognition of your valuable assistance to the country?" I asked. He replied, "Yes, I would like you to do something for my people." That was the fount and origin of the famous declaration about the national home for Jews in Palestine. The famous declaration came to be called the Balfour Declaration, a commitment by the British government in the form of a letter from Arthur Balfour to Baron Edmund de Rothschild to view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and to use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. That document originated far more complexly than in simple payment for Weizmann's biochemical services. Other spokesmen and statesmen were at work as well, and Weizmann's 2,000 interviews need to be counted in. Smuts identified the relationship long after the war when he said that Weizmann's outstanding war work as a scientist had made him known and famous in high Allied circles, and his voice carried so much the greater weight in pleading for the Jewish national home. But despite these necessary qualifications, Lloyd George's version of the story deserves better than the condescension historians usually accord it. A letter of 118 words signed by the Foreign Secretary committing His Majesty's government to a Jewish homeland in Palestine at some indefinite future time, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, can hardly be counted an unseemly reward for saving the guns of the British Army and Navy from premature senility. Chaim Weizmann's experience was an early and instructive example of the power of science in time of war. Government took note. So did science. A heavy German artillery bombardment preceded the Second Battle of Ypres that began on April 22, 1915. Ypres was, or had been, it hardly existed anymore, a modest market town in southeastern Belgium, about 8 miles north of the French border and less than 30 miles inland from the French port of Dunkirk. Around Ypres spread shell-cratered, soggy downland dominated by unpromising low hills, the highest of them, Hill 60 on the military maps, volcanically contested, only 180 feet elevation. A line of Allied and, parallel northeastward, of German trenches curved through the area,
and placed since the previous November. Before then, the German attacking and the British defending, the two armies had run a race to the sea. The Germans had hoped to win the race, to turn the flank of the Allies. Not yet fully mobilized for war, they even threw in ersatz corps of ill-trained high school and university students to bolster their numbers, and took 135,000 casualties in what the German people came to call the Kindermord, the murder of the children. But at the price of 50,000 lives, the British held the narrow flank. The war that was supposed to be surgically brief, a quick march through Belgium, France's capitulation home by Christmas, turned to a stagnant war of opposing trenches, in the Ypres salient, as everywhere, along the battle line from the Channel to the Alps. The April 22nd bombardment, the beginning of a concerted German attempt at breakthrough, had driven the Canadians and French Africans holding the line at Ypres deep into their trenches. At sunset, it lifted. German troops moved back from the front line along perpendicular communication trenches, leaving behind only newly trained pionniers, combat engineers. A German rocket signal went up. The pionnier set to work opening valves. A greenish-yellow cloud hissed from nozzles and drifted on the wind across no man's land. It blanketed the ground, flowed into craters, over the rotting bodies of the dead, through wide brambles of barbed wire, drifted then across the sandbagged Allied parapets and down the trench walls, past the fire steps, filled the trenches, found dugouts and deep shelters. And men who breathed it screamed in pain and choked. It was chlorine gas, caustic and asphyxiating. It smelled as chlorine smells and burned as chlorine burns. Masses of Africans and Canadians stumbled back in retreat. Other masses, surprised and utterly uncomprehending, staggered out of their trenches into no man's land. Men clawed at their throats, stuffed their mouths with shirt tails or scarves, tore the dirt with their bare hands, and buried their faces in the earth. They writhed in agony, 10,000 of them, serious casualties, and 5,000 others died. Entire divisions abandoned the line. Germany achieved perfect surprise. All the belligerents had agreed, under the Hague Declaration of 1899 concerning asphyxiating gases, to abstain from the use of projectiles, the sole object of which is the diffusion of asphyxiating or deleterious gases. None seemed to think tear gas covered by this declaration, though tear gases are more toxic than chlorine in sufficient concentration. The French used tear gas in the form of rifle grenades as early as August 1914. The Germans used it in artillery shells fired against the Russians at Bolimal at the end of January 1915, and on the Western Front first against the British at Nieuport in March. But the chlorine attack at Ypres was the first major and deliberate poison gas attack of the war. As later with other weapons of unfamiliar effect, the chlorine terrorized and bewildered. Men threw down their rifles and decamped. Medical officers at aid stations were suddenly overwhelmed with casualties, the causes of whose injuries was unknown. Chemists among the men who survived the attack recognized chlorine quickly enough, however, and knew how easy it was to neutralize. Within a week, the women of London had sewn 300,000 pads of muslin-wrapped cotton for soaking in hyposulfite, the first crude gas masks. Even though the German High Command allowed the use of gas at Ypres, it apparently doubted its tactical value. It had massed no reserve troops behind the lines to follow up. Allied divisions quickly closed the gap. Nothing came of the attack, except agony. Otto Hahn, a lieutenant in the infantry reserve, helped install the gas cylinders, 5,730 of them, containing 168 tons of chlorine, originally at a different place in the line. Shovel crews dug them into the forward walls of the trenches at fire step level and sandbagged them thickly to protect them from shellfire. To work them, you connected lead pipe to their valves, ran the pipe over the parapet into no man's land, waited for a rocket to signal a start, and opened the valves for a predetermined time. Chlorine boils at negative 28.5 degrees Fahrenheit unpressurized. It boiled out eagerly when released. But the prevailing winds had been wrong where Hahn's team of pionieri first installed the chlorine cylinders. By the time the high command decided to remove them to Ypres along a four-mile front where the wind blew more favorably, Hahn had been sent off to investigate gas attack conditions in the Champagne. In January, he was ordered to German-occupied Brussels to see Fritz Haber. Haber had just been promoted from reserve sergeant major to captain, an unprecedented leap in rank in the aristocratic German army. He needed the rank, he told Hahn, to accomplish his new work. Haber informed me that his job was to set up a special unit for gas warfare. It seems that Hahn was shocked. Haber offered reasons. They were reasons that would be heard again in time of war. He explained to me that the Western fronts, which were all bogged down, could be got moving again only by means of new weapons. One of the weapons contemplated was poison gas. When I objected that this was a mode of warfare violating the Hague Convention, he said that the French had already started it, though not to much effect, by using rifle ammunition filled with gas. Besides, it was a way of saving countless lives if it meant that the war could be brought to an end sooner. Hahn followed Haber to work on gas warfare. So did the physicist, James Franck, head of the physics department at Haber's Institute, who, like Haber and Hahn, would later win the Nobel Prize. So did a crowd of industrial chemists employed by IG Farben, a cartel of eight chemical companies assembled in wartime by the energetic Carl Duisberg of Bayer. The plant at Leverkusen, with the new lecture hall, turned up hundreds of known toxic substances, many of them dye precursors and intermediates, and sent them off to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physical Chemistry and Electrochemistry for study. Berlin acquired depots for gas storage and a school where Hahn instructed in gas defense. He also directed gas attacks. In Galicia, on the Eastern Front in mid-June 1915, the wind was favorable, and we discharged a very poisonous gas, a mixture of chlorine and phosgene, against the Russian enemy lines. Not a single shot was fired. The attack was a complete success. Because of its massive chemical industry, which supplied the world before the war, Germany was far ahead of the Allies in the production of chemicals for gas warfare. Early in the war, the British had even been reduced to buying German dyestuffs, not for gas, for dyeing, through neutral countries. When the Germans discovered the subterfuge, they proposed, with what compounding of cynicism and labored Teutonic humor the record does not reveal, to trade dyestuffs for scarce rubber and cotton. But France and Britain went immediately to work. By the end of the war, at least 200,000 tons of chemical warfare agents had been manufactured and used, half by Germany, half by the several Allies together. Abrogating the Hague Convention opened an array of new ecological niches, so to speak, in weaponry. Types of gas and means of delivery then proceeded to diversify, like Darwin's finches. Germany introduced phosgene next after chlorine, mixing it with chlorine for cloud gas attacks, like Hahn's, because of its slow rate of evaporation. The French retaliated in early 1916 with phosgene artillery shells. Phosgene then became a staple of the war, dispensed from cylinders, artillery shells, trench mortars, canisters fired from mortar-like projectors, and bombs. It smelled like new-mown hay, but it was by far the most toxic gas used, 10 times as toxic as chlorine, fatal in 10 minutes at a concentration of 0.5 milligram per liter of air. At higher concentrations, 1 or 2 breaths killed in a matter of hours. Phosgene, carbonyl chloride, hydrolyzed to hydrochloric acid in contact with water. That was its action in the water-saturated air, deep in the delicate, bubbled tissue of the human lung. It caused more than 80% of the war's gas fatalities. Chlorpicrin, the British called it vomiting gas, the Germans called it Klopp. A vicious compound of picric acid and bleaching powder came along next. German engineers used it against Russian soldiers in August 1916. Its special virtue was its chemical inertness. It did not react with the several neutralizing chemicals packed in gas mask canisters. Only the modest layer of activated charcoal in the canisters removed it from the air by absorption. So a high concentration could saturate the charcoal and get through. It worked like tear gas, but induced nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea as well. Men raised their masks to vomit. If the Klopp had been mixed with phosgene, as it frequently was, they might then be lethally exposed. Chlorpicrin's other advantage was that it was simple and cheap to make. The most horrible gas of the war, the gas that started a previously complacent United States developing a chemical warfare capacity of its own, was dichloroethyl sulfide, known for its horseradish or mustard-like smell as mustard gas. The Germans first used it on the night of July 17, 1917, in an artillery bombardment against the British at Ypres. The attack came as a complete surprise and caused thousands of casualties. Defense in the form of effective masks and efficient gas discipline had caught up with offense by the summer of 1917. Germany introduced mustard gas to break the deadlock, just as it had introduced chlorine before. Shells marked with yellow crosses rained down on the men at Ypres. At first, they experienced not much more than sneezing, and many put away their masks. Then they began vomiting. Their skin reddened and began to blister. Their eyelids inflamed and swelled shut. They had to be led away blinded to aid stations, more than 14,000 of them over the next 3 weeks. Though the gas smelled like mustard in dense concentrations, in low concentrations, still extremely toxic, it was hardly noticeable. It persisted for days and even weeks in the field. A gas mask alone was no longer sufficient protection. Mustard dissolved rubber and leather. It soaked through multiple layers of cloth. One man might bring enough back to a dugout on the sole of his boot to blind temporarily an entire nest of his mates. Its odor could also be disguised with other gases. The Germans sometimes chose to disguise mustard with xylobromide, a tear gas that smells like lilac. And so it came to pass in the wartime spring that men ran in terror from a breeze scented with blossoming lilac shrubs. These are not nearly all the gases and poisons developed in the boisterous, vicious laboratory of the Great War. There were sneezing gases and arsenic powders and a dozen tear gases and every combination. The French loaded artillery shells with cyanide, to no point except hatred, as it turned out, because the resulting vapors were lighter than air and immediately lofted away. By 1918, a typical artillery barrage locomoting east or west over the front lines counted nearly as many gas shells as high explosives. Germany, always logical at war to the point of inhumanity, blamed the French and courted a succession of increasingly desperate breakthroughs. The chemists, like bargain hunters, imagined they were spending a pittance of tens of thousands of lives to save a purse full more. Britain reacted with moral outrage, but capitulated in the name of parity. It was more than Fritz Haber's wife could bear. Clara Imhervar had been Haber's childhood sweetheart. She was the first woman to win a doctorate in chemistry from the University of Breslau. After she married Haber and bore him a son, a neglected housewife with a child to raise, she withdrew progressively from science and into depression. Her husband's work with poison gas triggered even more desperate melancholy. She began to regard poison gas not only as a perversion of science, but also as a sign of barbarism. A Haber biographer explains. It brought back the tortures men said they had forgotten long ago. It degraded and corrupted the discipline, that is chemistry, which had opened new vistas of life. She asked, argued, finally adamantly demanded that her husband abandon gas work.
Haber told her what he had told Hahn, adding for good measure, patriot that he was, that a scientist belongs to the world in times of peace, but to his country in times of war. Then he stormed out to supervise a gas attack on the Eastern Front. Dr. Clara Imhervar Haber committed suicide the same night. The Allied campaign at Gallipoli began on April 25, 1915. The rough, southward-descending Gallipoli Peninsula looked westward toward the Aegean, eastward across the narrow strait known as the Dardanelles, to the Ancients and to Lord Byron, the Hellespont. It faced Turkish Asia. Capture the peninsula, control the Dardanelles, then the Sea of Marmara above, then the narrow Bosporus Strait that divides Europe from Asia, then Constantinople, and you might control the Black Sea, into which the Danube drains, a vast flanking movement against the Central Powers. Such were the ambitions of the War Cabinet, chivied by Winston Churchill, for the Dardanelles campaign. The Turks, whose land it was, backed by the Germans, opposed the operation with machine guns and howitzers. One Australian, one New Zealand, one French colonial, and two British divisions landed at Gallipoli to establish narrow beachheads. The water of one beachhead bay churned as white at first as a rapid, the Turks pouring down 10,000 rounds a minute from the steep cliffs above. Then it bloomed thick and red with blood. Geography, error, and six Turkish divisions under a skillful German commander forestalled any effective advance. By early May, when a British Gurkha and a French division arrived to replace the Allied depletions, both sides had chiseled trenches in the stony ground. The standoff persisted into summer. Sir Ian Hamilton, the Allied commander, Corfu-born, literary, with a boar-stiffened right arm and the best of intentions, appealed for reinforcements. The War Cabinet had reorganized itself and expelled Churchill. It assented with reluctance to Hamilton's appeal and shipped out five divisions more. Harry Moseley shipped out among them. He was a signaling officer now, 38th Brigade, 13th Infantry Division, one of Lord Kitchener's new army batches made up of dedicated but inexperienced civilian volunteers. At Gibraltar on June 20th, he signaled his mother, "Our destination no longer in doubt." At Alexandria on June 27, he made his will, leaving everything, which was £2,200, to the Royal Society, strictly to be applied to the furtherance of experimental research in pathology, physics, physiology, chemistry, or other branches of science, but not in pure mathematics, astronomy, or any branch of science which aims merely at describing, cataloging, or systematizing. Alexandria was full of heat flies, native troops, and Australians, and after a week, they sailed on to Cape Helles, on the southern extremity of the Gallipoli Peninsula, a relatively secure bay behind the trench lines. There, they could ease into combat in the form of artillery shells lobbed over the Dardanelles to Europe, as it were, from Turkish batteries in Asia. If men were bathing in the bay, a lookout on the heights blew a trumpet blast to announce a round coming in. Centipedes and sand, Harry dispensing chlorodyne to his men to cure them of the grim amoebic dysentery everyone caught from the beaches. Harry in silk pajamas, sharing out the glorious tip-tree blackberry jam his mother sent. The one real interest in life